Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Look, I'm really excited to introduce our next guest, our first guest, because dispatches from Lindsay Hilsum, the international editor at Channel 4 News, has for decades now been informing us of what is happening in some of the most troubled hotspots in the world. And later today, Lindsay, the multi-award winning journalist, will be giving a talk as part of the Galway International Arts Festival on Ukraine and Russia. And right now she is on the line from Galway. Good morning. Good morning to you, Lindsay.
Good morning, Deborah. It's lovely to be here. Lovely. I wish I could say in sunny Galway, but look, it's not raining right now.
It's not raining right now. And actually, given the heat across different parts of the world, some people are perhaps a little bit relieved for our Irish summer spells. But look, it's just as well we're speaking to you, Lindsay, because this event at the Galway International Arts Festival has long been sold out. And, you know, when you look at the range of your work as a foreign correspondent, and the reach of it is incredible. You know, one of the first journalists on the ground at the genocide in Rwanda, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and of course, most recently, Ukraine, which we will get to chat about. But what is it about humanity and extremists that brought you into this field? What drew you to it?
Well, I suppose I had long wanted adventure, if I'm honest. And I also, you know, when I was 18, 19, I wanted to change the world. And I think we have to say that that was one of my less successful projects. But I started off as an aid worker and a volunteer. I worked with Oxfam in Central America so long ago, I'm not going to give you the date. And then I got another job as a volunteer with the UN Children's Fund in East Africa. So I went and lived in Kenya. And then sort of a little while into that, a couple of years into that, I just realized that I wasn't much use as an aid worker, that I wasn't a doctor, I wasn't a nurse, I didn't have any understanding of agriculture. And in fact, all I could do was read and write and ask questions. So I thought I'd better become a journalist instead.
And were there early signs, like when you look back in your childhood, you know, was there anything that was, drawing you to that? Was it just that sense of adventure or perhaps even being attracted to that sense of danger?
No, I don't think the danger thing. Certainly my mother was very big in the local Oxfam group. So I think it did start very much with this idea of trying to right the wrongs of the world. I mean, my parents were pretty political, you know, that they were, we always talked about politics and so on around the dinner table, as you say. So I did grow up with that conscience and that sense of the world. And we did, you know, we're talking about the 60s and 70s here. You know, we went to Europe on our holidays. My mother was a French teacher and I studied Spanish and French. So I was always interested in the world beyond, initially Europe. And then, you know, when I grew up, beyond Europe.
Yeah, and look, I mean, your career has brought you to your vocation. I really probably should say it's brought you to some of the, you know, the worst and most troublesome hotspots in the world. And I was struck, you know, by a conversation that you're having with your great friend, Lee Stussett, who's the BBC's chief international correspondent, and where you're discussing, you know, the fact that no story is worth dying for, but some are worth taking risks for. How did you manage that across the course of your career, or you know, how much did that maxim inform the work that you were doing, the places that you did go or perhaps didn't go?
Well, I think when I look back, like most of us, I look back at the risks I took when I was in my early 20s and my hair stands on end because I thought I was bulletproof and I didn't really think about it. You know, I just thought, oh, my God, I've got to be there. I mean, I can remember hitchhiking from Burundi through Rwanda to Goma in the middle of the genocide when the refugees started to leave Rwanda for Goma. That's in what was then called Zaire. I just had to get there. I just had to get there. And I didn't really think, you know, is hitchhiking such a great thing to do in this way? Well, I thought, I've got to get there somehow. So, you know, I was like that in those days. And I have become a lot more cautious, and part of the reason I've become more cautious is because I have lost friends. My friend Marie Colvin, who worked for the Sunday Times, was killed in Babarama, in Homs, in Syria, in February 2012. And that was, you know, she went in on the rebel side with her photographer, Paul Conroy, who's a very close friend of mine. And I didn't go with them because I said the risk is too great. And look, you know, I was right. The risk was too great.
Yeah, I trained as a young journalist in the Sunday Times, and I just remember the excitement on a Friday or Saturday night when Marie's copy would drop, and we would just, you know, get a chance to get the early glimpse before it hit the streets, and just being fascinated, you know, by her. But you wrote a book about her, and I'm just wondering, what was it that you learnt about her in death that you didn't know about her during her lifetime? Because she was a complicated character.
Look, so much. And it's a very strange thing to get to know your friend better in death than life. And of course, I read her childhood diaries, you know, the diaries that she wrote when she was 13. And, you know, they made my heart leap because they were so sweet and so lovely. And then I would... There was a marvelous one. She came from a big American Irish Catholic family, and they would have to go to mass every Sunday, which of course the 13-year-old Marie was not so keen on. And I can remember one entry where she wrote, "The church, war mini, the mother and the father no like." And I thought, oh yes, oh yes. I knew the rebellious little girl. I knew the very adventurous and brave woman she grew up into. And so all of that. But then also with Marie, I don't think I understood how unhappy she was. I mean, she had the worst taste in men. Oh my God. You know, abysmal taste in men. And of course, I sort of knew that at the time. And, you know, there were long nights in a bar talking about how awful so-and-so was, or how awful so-and-so was. But how deep it cut her and how much she suffered and was traumatized after she lost the sight in her left eye when she was shot in Sri Lanka.
Didn't we, Lindsay? We had this image of her. I think someone described it as the whiff of danger, but the whiff of glamour, you know, about her. And the world just saw her as this, which she was, an incredibly, incredibly brave person. And I think probably in life, but also in her death, she's been mythologized. But when you look back, whether it was in her personal life or perhaps her professional life, do you now think perhaps she was reckless in going back when perhaps others like you would have stood back and said, no, that's one risk too far?
Look, I find that it's a very difficult question because the answer is yes. Of course, the answer is yes. She was reckless. And yes, of course, it's painful to say that and to criticize her in death. But she was reckless and she shouldn't have gone back into Syria. And she rang me. You know, I spoke to her on the satellite phone a few hours before she was killed, and I was angry with her. I said, what the hell are you doing? You know, why did you go back in? What is your exit plan? What is your exit plan? And she said, well, that's just it. We haven't got one. I'm working on it now. And I was furious with her. That the last conversation we had, I was furious with her for that.
But would many people in your field not just say, well, look, yes, the risks are there, but look, it's what we do. You know, and she often, probably one of the advantages and disadvantages of working for a Sunday title is that you've often to be in first and last out. You know, you're there for longer than people are, and perhaps you need to take that extra bit to go the extra mile to get the extra stories.
Well, there's some truth in that, but I also think that our perceptions of this have changed because of Marie's death and because of the death of others as well. And I think that there's a lot more consciousness about all this on the part of our employers now. I mean, I work for Channel 4 News and I work in a team. I'm not making decisions by myself. And you get this sort of rhythm going in a team, which is, so, you know, I can pretend to be braver than I am in the full knowledge that the producer will say, no, Lindsay, we're not going to do that. And so, you know, you have a bit of push and pull within a team. And that's actually very, very healthy. And yes, you calculate the risk. But you know, you look at the different situations. I mean, people often say to me, oh, you know, Ukraine is so dangerous. I say, yes, of course there's danger in Ukraine. But you can make judgments about how near the front line to go or how near not to go. And yet I was talking to a friend the other day who's just been in Haiti. Now, Haiti, it's, you know, 95% of the capital, Port-au-Prince, is run by gangs. And it's who are armed, and they are, they are completely, there's no law and order at all. It's anarchy. Now, that kind of situation to me is much more frightening than a war, because there are no rules. And that's where anything can happen at any time. And those are the kind of situations that at this point in my life, I try and avoid. That is beyond my danger threshold.
But Lindsay, was there a time where perhaps the rules of war did protect journalists, you know, or do we live in a new world order now where journalists and perhaps especially investigative or foreign correspondents are targets, that perhaps that old, you know, system of somehow respecting the work the journalist does, has that fallen away, do you think, in recent times?
Well, it certainly changed in my lifetime, because when I, you know, when I started in the 1980s, you know, any sort of a warlord who you met, say, and I often worked in Africa at that point, in places like Sudan or Ethiopia or whatever, and they would need journalists in the sense that they, if they wanted to get their message out, whatever it might be, they would need to talk to a journalist. Of course, now you can do things directly through social media or, you know, your own YouTube channel, whatever it is. And even before that, they didn't really know exactly what we did. I mean, I worked for BBC Africa Service, so people would listen in Africa. But there was no satellite television and so on. So they weren't really as aware as people are now that what are we looking for? We're looking for the human rights abuses that they've committed. We're looking for all the terrible things that they've done. We're trying to catch them out. That's what we're trying to show, how cruel and terrible these people are. And to some extent, they didn't really know that because they didn't see it themselves. Now they see it. And I think that that's one of the reasons that that journalists have become targets in a way they weren't necessarily before.
And how do you keep your composure, Lindsay, when you're out in the field? Like, I mean, is it sort of, do you imagine that foreign correspondents are sort of have to have, you know, hearts of kind of ice in order to be foreign correspondents? Or what kind keeps you sane and committed when you're on the road and navigating all of those risks with you and your teams?
Well, again, it's the team thing, and there's a certain amount of black humour, as you can imagine, and also you're looking out for each other. So I think that that's really important. But also, I mean, it's to do with one's own personality. The worse the situation, the calmer I become, and that's just how it is. So we were last November, December, we were in Ukraine in a trench. We'd gone to look at the trenches because, of course, I'm obsessed with the trenches, as many of us are, and the Somme, and, you know, how the battlefield in Ukraine looks like World War One. And so there we were in these filthy, muddy, rain-soaked trenches. And then suddenly there's the sound of a sniper overhead. So we have to slide down and just sit in the trench until the sniper stops. And, the guys we're with, the Ukrainians, are firing back and suppressive, what they call suppressive fire, to stop the sniper. And in that situation, I just don't panic. And none of my team panics. I work with a wonderful team. And so we all know what we have to do. The cameraman has to keep filming. I have to do a piece to camera. Producer sometimes, at that point, the producer actually did look at me and make the sign of the Muppets, like, why aren't you doing your piece to camera? Why are you just sitting there? Everybody does what they have to do.
And you must phone, I don't know whether they sort of become like your family, but you must forge incredibly close, relationships with people when you're on that sort of a journey or mission together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love them. I love them. I don't know if they love me, but I love them. That's for sure.
And tell me, just in terms of, you know, television and, of course, our attention spans, you know, in the age of kind of like the 90-second soundbite, is it harder now to tell those complex stories accessibly in a matter sometimes just of minutes?
It is difficult, but I certainly agree. I think that people's attention spans have diminished. I think my attention span has diminished, to be honest. I'm just as bad as everybody else, you know, doom scrolling through Twitter instead of reading a proper book. But I think, you know, that we just have to get better at our jobs at doing that and making it engaging. And I've always believed, and I still believe, that the trick to it is to do both to do the frontline reporting and the analysis at the same time. Because I think that if you just do the frontline or you just do the stories of the victims, then people go, you know, oh, how scary, or oh, what a shame, how terrible, with no kind of understanding of why this is happening. And if you just sit in a studio, you know, standing like some superannuated general pointing at a map, that's really boring. You have to do the two together. You have to show what's happening, show what it feels like, show how people feel, show people's emotions, show the lives that people are living in these villages near the front line, but also have some explanation of why it's happening. Because if you don't put the two together, then I think it becomes meaningless to the viewers.
I want to just ask you about, and I'm sort of loath to use the phrase because it's become a little bit hackneyed, but, you know, women on the front line. But there's no doubt that that to a large extent, or certainly previously, when it came to foreign correspondence, it was largely a male-dominated profession. But, you know, people like yourself and Marie and Lise would have been, you know, pioneers in that field. Were you ever consciously aware of gender, or were you just foreign correspondents who just happened to be doing what they were doing?
Well, I think the pioneers are a bit earlier, actually. I think the pioneers of World War II are Martha Gellhorn and Lee Miller, you know. So I think that, you know, they're certainly the women I look at and see as role models and people who I really admire. And I think I think that they had it much harder. And maybe it's history that makes me look at them and think, oh, they were so glamorous, weren't they? But for us, my generation, no, I didn't worry. I didn't ever worry about it. I don't think it's ever stopped me from doing anything. But I look at the younger generation now and I see a lot of younger women in their 30s coming up and quite often now, the majority of foreign correspondents, of the reporters, and certainly of producers in TV are women. And the one field where I see fewer women still is camera. On camera operating, it's still pretty male dominated. I have friends who are female camera operators, but I think that's the last barrier, and we're not quite through that one yet.
Yeah. And what about the barrier of age? I know that you and Lise from the BBC, I'd have no entertaining for people who think that TV journalism is for the young. More old bats on the box is your movement.
We have a movement of two, more old bats on the box, or sometimes more old trouts on TV. Look, I love my work and I don't want to stop doing it. But the point where I would stop doing it is if I became a liability to my team. So we cannot say at this point that I am the fastest runner. We are not going to pretend that. In fact, I'm a bit rubbish when it comes to running. But I'm all right at lying down and keeping still. I can do that bit. But if I ever felt I was putting other people in danger, then I would stop doing this, or else somebody might have to take me on one side and say, Lindsay, the time has come. But I don't want to stop doing it. And okay, look, maybe to younger correspondents, I'm like a bed blocker in the National Health Service, you know. Why doesn't that old woman just get out of the way and let us there? But, you know, until they shove me on one side, I'm going to carry on doing it.
Well, sometimes your age and dignity does come into play in a good way, because you got mistaken for the Queen of England at one point, and that actually assisted you on the front line.
Oh, yeah. No, in Ukraine, particularly at the beginning, basically in last year, at the beginning of the war in Ukraine, journalists were something of a novelty. But also in Ukraine, it's one of the few places I've been to where being British is actually a real advantage. Normally I get a lecture on colonialism. But in Britain, because the British have given a lot of weapons and very much supported the cause, we're quite happy to be British and people like to see us. But there's certainly, before Her Majesty died, there was a whole thing about her. And, you know, to get through roadblocks, it wasn't that people wanted to stop us. They were very curious, and I would not really understand what Maxime, our local producer, was saying. And eventually I asked him, he said, well, you know, I found three lines would get us through the roadblocks. The first was, very famous journalist, and which is not true. The second one was, friend of the Queen. That was also not true. And the third one, very curiously, if those two didn't work, was saw Gaddafi's body with her own eyes. Oh. And at that point, woof, we were straight through. Don't ask me why.
So sometimes those long years of experience can help. Can I bring you forward? Can I bring you forward to obviously currently, you know, what's happening in Ukraine? But first of all, just kind of the hierarchies of, you know, how we deal with different conflicts, because obviously Ukraine is very much to the forefront in our minds, but there could be conflicts elsewhere, Palestine or Syria. It's just as devastating to those people's lives, but perhaps the public's interest isn't sustained in the same way. Do you struggle with that?
I struggle with it all the time, and I feel that whatever I'm doing, I should be doing something else. And there are always things going on out of the corner of my eye. And the one I feel very strongly at the moment about is Sudan. And I'm very glad that my colleague, Porrick O'Brien, has just been in Chad reporting on what's going on in Darfur. And, you know, Darfur, is it a genocide? It's as close as you can get, with the Masalit people being slaughtered by the Rapid Support Forces, which are, you know, one of the parties in the current civil war in Sudan, and they evolved from the Janjaweed, which some people may remember from 20 years ago. And I reported on Darfur and the terrible atrocities, the burning of villages, the rapes that were carried out by the Janjaweed in the early 2000s. And now we're seeing history repeating itself. And, you know, that's one of the things about getting older, because, you know, part of me just wants to be there and report that. And another part of me thinks I'm so glad that it was somebody else who went and reported that. Partly because sometimes in this job, you have to be newly outraged. And Porrick and Zara, the producer he was working with, were horrified and outraged. And that came through in their reporting, which was incredibly powerful. And, you know, for me, of course I'm outraged, but sometimes when you see things happening again and again, you just want to cry. Yeah. You don't have that power of seeing something for the first time. It just makes me want to sit down and cry about how awful it is. So in those ways, I hope at Channel 4 News that we are, you know, covering all those stories. Another colleague of mine, Secunda Kamani, was just in Jenin. Now, Jenin in the West Bank, and reporting that. And so, you know, even when I feel guilty or, you know, I feel bad, I should be there, you know, other people, I don't have to do everything myself. That would be ridiculous.
And has social media, you know, the rise of the video journalist, the rise of the citizen journalist, you know, you were saying that networks do care more perhaps about the physical and mental health of their reporters. Has that changed much of the work of the foreign correspondents? That more sort of a direct accessibility, but perhaps without those filters of fact-checking and everything else that goes with your work?
Well, I think, look, there's a complicated issue there, particularly in Syria. It became very, very difficult to report Syria because if you went in on the rebel side, you might get killed, like Marie, or you might get captured and kidnapped by the Islamic State, as happened to others, and then killed. And so that was extremely difficult. But then obviously there's an issue with what we call citizen journalists, if they're activists and on one particular side and so on. And so you have to work through all that. But what we did in the end was two things. One is that we employed somebody who was Lebanese, who was going through all of that footage and verifying it and working out what was where and so on. Incredible expertise. And also we had Wad al-Khatib, a wonderful Syrian journalist who was an activist, but the stories that she was able to bring from East Aleppo, which was rebel-held territory, the kind of things, you know, I could never have done because she was able to be there and because, you know, I mean, the story was partly herself getting married, having a baby under fire. I mean, or she was absolutely incredible. So I think that this has broadened out the way we report. And I think this is really good. And I think it brings really different aspects of conflict home to viewers, and they really respond. But we need to do it while keeping up the standards of verification and also taking care of those people. Waad was a local Syrian journalist, but she is just as precious to us, and her physical and mental health is just as precious to us as anybody else.
I know the work that you've done in the wake of Marie Colvin's death with the Circle and supporting female reporters on the ground all over the world has in itself been groundbreaking, but I cannot let you go, Lindsay Hilson, without talking about Ukraine. Earlier this week, the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar made a surprise visit to there, and here we have war once again on the continent of Europe. And I wanted to ask you, how different is this to other wars, and what do you make of yesterday's accusation by Russian President Vladimir Putin, who seemed to be putting Poland on notice that any activity or aggression towards its neighbour and ally Belarus would be considered an attack on Russia? Suddenly, literally overnight, it feels closer than ever, this conflict.
Well, certainly what Putin has been trying to do from the beginning is to paint this as a conflict between NATO and Russia, and to blame NATO and to say that these are the two sides, wherein that is not the case. This is a conflict which was caused by Russia invading Ukraine. And, you have to keep that in mind the whole time. But the reason that President Putin is doing that is to whip up the rest of the world to try and get more allies. And he's not unsuccessful. Many countries in Africa, their governments, which see Russia as an anti-imperialist power, as they saw the Soviet Union fighting against Western colonialism, British, French colonialism, they're very open to this idea. And so that's very useful for him. And that's one of the reasons he keeps pumping that idea. But I think that, I think that Ukraine is a conflict which is unique in my lifetime, in that it is this really big threat. Of course, we've had conflicts in my lifetime in Europe before, not least Bosnia and Kosovo in the Balkans. But this is one where Russia is trying to bring the conflict to us. And it puts NATO in a very, very difficult situation of to what extent to say, yes, we have to protect Ukraine, and to what extent to say, no, Ukraine is not part of NATO, and therefore, we provide weapons, but we definitely don't provide soldiers. And that makes it a very difficult conflict, a very difficult dilemma for Western governments. It doesn't make it difficult for us to cover. It's one of the most accessible conflicts, and I think we're able to cover it, except we can only cover the Ukrainian side. We can't go to Russia. So our coverage is incomplete. And that, I think, is really difficult, because we try as much as we can to cover all sides of conflicts. On this occasion, it's very difficult to do so.
Yeah, and that is, in fact, going to be the topic of your conversation with Fintan O'Toole in the Human Biology Building at the University of Galway later on today. It's Ukraine versus Russia. And unfortunately, the tickets to your event are long sold out. So we're absolutely thrilled to speak to you. Lindsay Hilsom, International Editor, Channel 4 News. Thank you so much for joining us today, and enjoy the rain in Galway. We'll take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.